Welcome to the Business Marketing Club podcast for B2B marketing people who want to get on and stay ahead. In each episode, we'll be offering insight and inspiration on a key current topic, advice on how to climb the career ladder, and top networking tips. I'm Dave Stevens. I'm a B2B marketer and I'm chair of the Business Marketing Club Network. In this episode, I'll be speaking to Gail Cogswell, the business consultant at 5200, to Michael Williamson, CEO of Loyalty AI, and to Lucy Stewart, the head of client services at CensusWide, for their tips on customer understanding and engagement. Plus, Gareth Case shares a key lesson that he's taken on the journey to being chief marketing officer at Red Store. And marketing and communications manager at Hitachi Vantara, Sara Fernandez, shares some great B2B marketing examples and what she's learned from them. Lots to cover, so let's get started. B2B marketing starts with the customer, but understanding the customer need can be difficult, particularly when the product or service or technology isn't yet on the market. I'm joined today by three experts on customer understanding and engagement. First up, Gail Cogswell, who's business consultant at 5200. Gail, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So first of all, you've got to tell me, what does 5200 do?
5200 was the altitude in meters that I was at when I decided that I was going to leave the world of PAYE and set up on my own as a consultancy. So it was actually a place in Bolivia.
Okay, so that's when you decided to do this. What are you doing?
Right, so we are a business consultancy. We specialise in marketing and business development in the innovation space. So our background is in telecommunications, but of course that has diversified hugely in the last 20 years. And now we work across, still with a heavy communications bent, but also in fintech, where there's lots of new exciting stuff happening.
And you're working in the space of 5G, I think, right now. So how developed is 5G as a technology?
Oh, well, as a technology, very developed, you know, up and running. Some countries doing much more impressive things than others at the moment, which is always the case when you have a new generation of mobile telecoms. So the technology itself is fine. It's the application of the technology, which is the challenge or the opportunity, whichever way you want to look at it this time, because it's not 4G, but faster. You know, when if you look at the history of, if you think of us as consumers with our mobile phones, we didn't really call 2G 2G, but still we had it. We went from 2 to 3 to 4G, and that was all about us interacting with our handsets, which went from being relatively dumb to smartphones. 5G is a completely different subject matter. And that's the bit that I think where there is this huge opportunity to get people to explore how it could really be quite transformative for key industries.
So it's uncharted territory. How do you go about understanding then that customer need?
It is a process. To begin with, I have to go in there with my toolkit, if you like, which is the understanding of 5G. So understanding it from a how does it work, not to the point that an engineer would, but you know, there's got to be some grounded knowledge of how it works. But really, what are the USPs that other technologies, other communication options don't bring? Because that will give you your sort of perfect storm as to where is the sweet spot in this market, because the market is yet to be defined. So that's what I have to go in with, sort of and then not talk about it to the customer. So that will be in my pocket or ready for when I need it. If I go in and talk to, let's say, a healthcare worker, the last thing they want in their busy schedule is for me to go in there and start talking tech jargon at them. It's irrelevant to them, but also no one likes being in a conversation where they feel like they're on the back foot. So it is my job to understand in their language what are the big barriers to them being super effective in their day-to-day. Ordinarily, I will go in there with a bit of a sort of an elevator pitch that tells people broadly this is what 5G can do, so that we at least talk about the right areas. Don't want to make the mistake of it becoming an IT conversation talking about LANs and WANs. So you want to make sure you're giving some direction, but then saying to people, so in your day-to-day life, how do you use communications? You know, where does it work? Where doesn't it work? And it's up to them, me then, to join the dots, really, to listen to what they're telling me, to say, right, is that worth a deep dive? Is that an area where the answer could be faster, secure connectivity, or is it irrelevant? Because, you know, 5G, like any technology I've ever worked with, it's not a silver bullet. So you have to find where the relevant application is.
And maybe you can help make it real and perhaps talk to a practical example. Perhaps if we stayed with your health example, you know, can you kind of paint the picture of who you're speaking to, where they are, how you might frame this unknown application to them?
Yeah, so in the health sector, because I mean it's huge, the health world is. My team and I held interviews with over 200 different health workers across the West Midlands, which is where I was focusing my time. And that is from blue light services, so ambulance, fire, police, through to transport police, care workers, all of our NHS frontline staff, and specialists and behind-the-scenes specialists, so radiologists, people that hopefully most of us don't ever have to spend that much time with, but, you know, they are a key part of some of the biggest demands on our health system at the moment. So,
and this is on-site, is it?
Mm-hmm, as much as possible, yes. I mean, you have to be practical with these things. You know, one of the big pressures that the health service is under is lack of resource. So you've got to be very pragmatic about how much time you can take. And often an interview with someone would have to take part in several episodes, because when they get called away, and you asking them questions about, I don't know, would it be helpful to have high def imaging, does not take priority over a patient. So yes, but it's in their world, in their environment.
You do tell a story, I think, of being abandoned on a street corner by an ambulance. I'm sure I've heard that.
by the paramedics, yeah. There aren't, you getting test material, anything medical, it's sort of like anyone who's ever planned a party and then accidentally let slip it's for a wedding, the price goes up tenfold. You put the word medical grade in front of anything, you get exactly the same. So kit and resources are very precious. So when we are trialing things like, what difference would 5G make to a paramedic's office, their ambulance? It's a real ambulance, it's a real paramedic. So when something else takes precedent, that's it, all bets are off, and yes, you're out, and that they go off and do what they need to do, because there aren't play kits for these things. They're too expensive and too precious and under a huge amount of demand.
What would you say are the do's and don'ts for going about understanding customer experience in this type of space?
Be absolutely honest, I'd say it's the first do, because a lot of what I work with is nascent. So you're not going in and doing a sales pitch saying, I've got this tried and tested product or proposition and these are the returns it will give you. You're saying, I think this could be really relevant to your world. Will you work with me? So you have to be absolutely candid with people. You can't give any guarantees. You need them to be brave. And some of this might fail. You know, it's a learning process for all of us. There is, every time some new technology comes out, there is, and it serves a purpose, but there is always a level of hype around it. And that hype is to get people excited. It's to get people sort of a bit familiar with the new language that comes out. But it also sort of creates a bit of a backlash of cynicism with it as well. And most people who are in a C-level position will remember 3G being launched, they'll remember 4G being launched, they'll remember Wi-Fi, and they'll have remembered all the promises that came with each of them. So if you turn up and say to somebody who runs a hospital trust, I've got something that can solve all your problems, well, that's the end of your conversation straight away. So you really do have to be just very, very, very clear from the off that this is an exciting opportunity, but it is, you know, it's brave new world time.
And sorry to interrupt, but I guess that then would be the advice that you would give to others who are trying to understand the customer in the space of innovation. It would be kind of don't over promise.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, and don't assume. That sounds so basic, doesn't it? But sometimes coming from the tech side of it, we get so excited about our new shiny toys that we sort of forget that there has to be a real world application for this to work. So sort of rushing into a situation and saying, imagine if all the care homes had 5G in them, and then you could do remote diagnostics without having to have all the overheads of conveyancing people from A to B. And you think all of that is great. Care homes have got a raft of problems, and implementing 5G is really not on the list at the moment. So, you know, you've got to have that almost a little bit of humility, I think, to understand that while from an innovation point of view, yes, this is really exciting, but you can't just go and barge into people's worlds and say, listen to me, take part in my scheme. You know, you've really got to be appreciative of the challenges that they're up against and find a reason for them to talk to you. So, listen, again, it sounds so very basic, but listening to people rather than assuming that because you know the tech, you know how it will best work, is absolutely key to it. Quite often, you know, I said at the beginning, you have to go in there with this knowledge of your technology. That's your starting point. I think you have to be really prepared to also accept that you're completely wrong, because it might be in a laboratory. Yes, that's true. But you take that in a factory or take that on a construction site, suddenly none of that rings true anymore. So you have to find alternative ways of looking at the same tech, different challenges.
Gail Cogswell, from the heights of Bolivia to the healthcare and 5G world, thank you very much for joining us. My next guest is Michael Williamson, who is CEO of Loyalty AI. Michael, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much, David. Very happy to be here.
It's good to have you here. So tell us, first of all, what does Loyalty AI do?
Yeah, well, essentially, we're seeing three major macro trends that we're thinking about for our clients. So essentially, the first is that choice and disruption is multiplying, so essentially driven by digitization. So digitization is accelerating. Often legacy brands are being disintermediated by scale-ups who have lower barriers to entry. And essentially the cost of getting into business, getting online, is essentially reducing. So there's more and more competition. The second thing is that SaaS is really becoming everything. So the way the world is thinking is about subscription, so consumption of subscription goods, so whether that's software or even other kinds of goods and services. So we hear the term the subscription economy, which kind of gives rise to this thing that we've been seeing in B2B marketing around the customer success manager. It's becoming more and more important for B2B organizations, not just to think about the acquisition element, but also the retention, the experience, in order to drive the longevity of that subscription that the B2B organization has acquired. And then the third thing is that marketing is becoming just a lot more transparent. So we're living in the world of social. So messages are a lot more difficult to be controlled by brands. They're essentially being controlled by people in terms of what they're sharing. So word of mouth is really a key component. So essentially what we're finding is that It's just becoming more and more important to retain and energize existing customers. So that's basically what we do. So essentially, we help brands define customer engagement and loyalty to win in this type of era. So we provide customer campaign strategy, motivational content, technology platforms, as well as predictive analytics.
Okay. I guess it's partly within the way that you've framed your answer there, but I'm interested in what you define customer loyalty and customer engagement as being.
Yes, I mean, Forrester, they talk about that we're in the age of the customer. And essentially, there's been many studies to show the correlation, but also causation between customer engagement and financial performance. So we've seen stats and various studies, essentially meta-analysis from around the world, that shows that 86% of consumers are willing to pay more for a great customer experience. Consumers with an emotional connection to a brand have a 306% higher lifetime value, and also measures such as companies that are on an experience-led strategy have a higher brand awareness, higher employee satisfaction, and also a higher average order value. So these things become a lot more important in the subscription economy.
So in that then, I guess it's important to really truly be able to understand the customer need. So how do you get under the skin of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the key thing here is that it's really about understanding customers and how they interact with an experience, and it's really about measuring that. So segmenting customers into like-minded groups, that could be as simple as putting them into personas. It could be having more complex analytics. But essentially what we're looking at, different types of behavior sets, and then essentially classifying them, then understanding and asking them what's important to them in terms of their buying experience. What is the most important aspect? And how would they rate your brand versus the competitors? And that's how you really get under the skin of what does the customer value most? Is it the onboarding experience? Is it the experience around the selling process? Is it the transitioning process? You know, what is it that's the most important to that customer group?
And once you've got that understanding, how do you go about delivering customer loyalty and engagement?
Yeah, so I think it's once we've got that level of understanding, then it's essentially about measuring those things and being quite ruthless about measuring them. So breaking apart those customer journeys, those connections of experiences, and then understanding where is the brand driving value and a great experience that customers care about most, and where is it not? And then ensuring that there are activities and plans to put in place in order to bring those experiences up. And there are various measures on doing so. So there's measures such as CXM, which is customer experience measurement. So a methodology of actually measuring and quantifying those experiences. And also more commonly, a term which has been used as return on customer experience. So this is something that CFOs care more and more about, which is, okay, well, you're telling me I should invest in getting a better customer experience. What's actually in it for the company in terms of financial performance? So more recently, return on experience has been one of the trends in terms of making sure that there is that causality.
Can you perhaps give us an example, a good example of a business delivering customer loyalty and engagement?
Yeah, so I can give you a couple of examples in terms of measurements that have been important. So Staples would be an example. So essentially Staples as an organization has gone through a lot of change, given that that category has predominantly been purchased online. So it went through a transition where it got out of retail stores and is now a pure play online player. And essentially services around 10 million B2B customers across Europe. So within that, there was an exercise that was conducted to look at the correlation between NPS and customer CLV, so customer profitability. And essentially there was a high level of causation that was tracked back to show that customers with a high NPS had a 60% higher customer profitability than those in the bottom level, the bottom quartile of NPS. Mm. That therefore linked a number of transformational practices around what measures should the company be putting in place in order to revise that customer experience, improve it, which then link back directly to profitability. Another good example, which a lot of the mobile telecoms companies are pursuing from a B2B and a B2C perspective, is the use of chatbots. So we've heard a lot about chatbots, got this robotic process automation era coming through, but essentially chatbots can help in the customer experience. So they can do complex tasks much quicker than the live agents. So thing is, if I call up and I want to, or I'm chatting through on my chatbot and I want to know what my bill is, or when my next bill will be, or how many minutes I've used, the chatbot can pull those records much quicker than a live agent. And what some of the major telecoms companies have found in Europe is that there's actually a 10% higher customer satisfaction interaction with a customer service center by delivering those basic queries through a chatbot versus through a live agent. So that would be a good example of improving the experience and then using some analytics around it.
Okay. A lot of people listening to this will be B2B marketers rather than B2C. So I wonder if you've got some advice for those B2B marketers who are listening, who are thinking what you're saying is quite interesting and want to begin building customer understanding, loyalty and engagement. Where do they start, or what do they need to think about?
Yeah, I mean, I would start at just get the measurement in place. Once you've got the measurement in place, the rest of it becomes pretty simple. So think about just classifying very simply the different types of customers you've got. You might just want to put them in four or five different pools, dependent upon the differences that you believe that there are. And then just have a regular survey with customers who are interacting with your firm. And then essentially ask them, what are those most important experiences in terms of dealing with the company? So that's kind of step one, so you know what's important. Mm. Step two is to then turn those things into a regular study, just to ask customers, well, on those things that are important to you, how would you rate us out of 10? And then just get them to score. And then that way you can work out, are you performing good? Are you not performing so well? And also, you know, the relative importance of those things. And then that can then start to drive some basic changes in terms of the way you're doing things. One B2B organization that I'm working with at the moment, they started this approach. And what they found is that they were good with many, many things, but the biggest pain point customers had was the transitioning time, the onboarding time. So they needed to make some changes around their model of how they actually helped customers switch out their old legacy platform onto their new platform. And that dramatically increased the experience of those clients.
Okay. So you've got to kind of start, I guess, by working out where you currently are and build from there.
Yes. Yes.
Michael Williamson, CEO of Loyalty AI. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Dave.
My third guest on this topic is Lucy Stewart, who is Head of Client Services at CensusWide. Lucy, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what does CensusWide do then?
So CensusWide, we're a research agency. And I suppose when you consider a research agency, two kind of methodologies come to mind, quantitative and qualitative. We deal with both of those different avenues and different types of research. quantitative is the surveys. That's what I'm going to talk to you about today. That's probably the majority of what we do. But I think apparent in this day and age is it's not kind of just one methodology that's going to do the job. Mixed methodologies are becoming more and more important. And I think that's where clients that we work with are really coming to us for the kind of the added service and running a survey and then following it up with something like a focus group, or running a focus group and then following it up with a survey. But essentially what we're doing, what we help clients to do, is develop insight, explore insights so that they understand target audiences, their consumers, but also generate content. So run what we call PR surveys that are going to generate headlines and do things like that, and articles and white papers. Essentially, we speak to large groups of people daily, and we use those stats that come of those surveys to do exactly that, develop insights and generate content.
Okay, so listeners to this podcast have got kind of previous on the subject of surveys. We've heard from previous guests that surveys don't work very well when you're trying to gauge customer experience and also customer obsession. So I've got to ask you, do you agree?
No, I don't agree. I love the question.
We'll delete the previous podcast straight away.
I mean, as I said at the beginning, I don't think it's as simple as to say research should just be qualitative. It shouldn't just be focus groups. And equally, I'm not here sitting and saying it should just be surveys. No, it's so much more complicated than that. But if you were going to ask me whether surveys have a purpose in this day and age, my answer is very, very clearly, yes. I think the main benefits and kind of advantages that surveys have are, number one, they're instantaneous almost. So you can go out to 1,000 general consumers, 2,000 general consumers, and within a matter of hours, you can have that data back. But you can't do that in a focus group. You have to spend time recruiting, getting the right people, developing the discussion guide, everything like that. So one huge benefit of a survey is that it is instantaneous. And you can have the views of huge numbers of people. I've said 1,000 general consumers, 2,000 general consumers. That tends to be what our sample sizes would be on the consumer side. That is a lot of people. And if you have created a nationally representative survey, so it meets the quotas of a population, then you can refer those stats to the population. So it's extremely valuable to be able to say within a matter of hours that X percent of the British public think X, Y, and Z. That is, as I say, hugely, hugely valuable. And I think if we look at the current climate and the current, obviously, time that we're living in, and we've got COVID-19 around us and everything is changing so, so quickly, I think surveys are really standing out from the crowd at the moment, because you are able to speak to the public as things are changing and ask them what their viewpoints are at any given time as a snapshot. And I don't think that's going to change at any time. I think that's always going to be really, really important for people to have.
So I'm hearing kind of speed, and also because of the size, the accuracy, the results are kind of the reasons that you point to for surveys working well.
Yes.
Can you give us an example? And I'd like to kind of push for a B2B related example, if possible. I'm less interested right now in the state of the general public than the state of general business.
Yeah, of course. So we've got a lot of kind of case studies of people that have done things recently. And one is a financial services company, and they came to us basically to poll their target audience to find out if they really knew who they were. They'd been operating for some time, and they'd been operating a lot on assumption. So speaking to their customers face-to-face, speaking to customers via email, relying on employees coming back and explaining their experience. But what they hadn't done for a while was speak to a large group of people to see what they wanted, what their attitudes were, what their pain points were. And what was really interesting from that piece of research was that there wasn't one clear-cut target audience. They couldn't put everyone into one category and say, okay, well, this is what our customer wants and this is what we need to be doing to fix that. They had about 7 different personas come out from the research. those seven different personas were then sent around the whole company. So digital marketing, marketing, and it enabled each kind of area of the business to operate very, very personally. So it might be, in most basic terms, okay, well, you've got a person of this age, of this gender, who's working with a household income of this, let's treat them in this manner, this is what's important to them. Whereas someone of this age group, of this gender, etc., this is what's going to kind of make them tick, and that's what's going to make us stand out and make sure that we're delivering the most appropriate service to them.
And can you say from that what the outcome was for the business? So they were much more targeted, I guess, in terms of what they went on to do. But do you know what the business results were from that?
I don't know exactly, but we spoke to them and they essentially said that their marketing teams were really, really happy because the feedback that they'd had from speaking to customers was that the personal approach was really, really valued. I think we're hearing kind of personal approach a lot at the moment, and it tends to be something that you hear that consumers are looking for. And I think that was the benefit for them, that they, when they were having these conversations and face-to-face with their customers, they were saying, thank you for that email, actually, that was really, really designed for me, and that made me think twice, and that made me act like this. Whereas had it been a kind of mass email that I knew you were sending to everyone, I probably wouldn't have done anything.
Okay, so I'm beginning to become a late convert to this survey.
Oh, brilliant.
But should my approach to surveys differ? Maybe according to the size of my business, maybe according to the age of my organisation, you know, those sorts of things.
I think whoever you are, whatever organisation you work for, you can treat surveys in the same way. You just need to be very, very careful that you don't fall down the pitfalls. And I think some issues that people can have with surveys are if they fall into the wrong hands, and if you don't quite know how to design a survey in the right way, you can end up with inaccurate data. So right. I think the most important thing for any type of organization, whether you're a small startup, whether you're a huge multinational, is that you are careful to design the questionnaire in a way that isn't leading, so that you know the respondents haven't been pushed to answer in a certain way. You know that the respondents have understood the questions. We obviously do a lot of B2B surveys, and it might be marketing directors of large companies, and we ask them a question that we are sure that they will understand. But just to avoid any element of doubt, you need to include caveats and make sure that things are super, super clear, so that you're removing any element of doubt when you look at the data, that the respondents have definitely understood that question. You also need to look at sample sizes, and maybe this is something that actually would differ for your startups and your large organizations. And right. Obviously, the respondents are incentivized. So the larger the sample, the more expensive that sample will be. But you do need to make sure that the sample is robust. What you need to look at is what we call the margin of error, which is calculated from a confidence level. You need to make sure that that is of a good percentage. So 1,000 general respondents, for example, and again, that's just general population, so not B2B, it becomes more complex at B2B level, but that would be plus or minus 3.1%, which means that you can be sure that the data at the end of the day is accurate by approximately 3%. So things like that are really, really important. It's no good speaking to five marketing directors within an online survey. You can speak to five marketing directors within a focus group, within face-to-face interviews, but if you're looking for quantitative data, which a survey is, you need a robust sample size. So I think so long as you're kind of not falling down those pitfalls and making sure that you are doing everything properly and correctly, then you will have accurate data at the end of the day, and your survey is going to be really valuable.
Lucy Stewart, Head of Client Services at CensusWide, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up, Gareth Case shares a key lesson that he's taken on the journey to being Chief Marketing Officer of Red Store. Gareth, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dave. Great to be here.
So what's made you the brilliant B2B marketer you are today then?
Wow, what a question. And I think quite a tough one to answer. I think it's probably down to a combination of a few things. If I look back to the early part of my career, I was incredibly lucky in my first job to be working within a team of 30 plus experienced marketers across Europe within a marketing exec role for a global technology business. And that role gave me some great exposure to all disciplines, from campaign management to lead generation, events, PR, comms, all things digital, albeit back in the late 90s. As far as digital went back then, I was trained from a graphic design perspective and pretty much everything else in between. And if I look back, that gave me an excellent grounding and also helped me understand which aspects of marketing I enjoyed and, equally as important, which ones I didn't. Which leads me on to something I've often thought about during my career and something that I've probably tried to offer advice to people that have worked for me before on, and that's the debate around generalists versus specialists. I think it's a pretty common question facing many marketers at varying points of their career, and if it's not, it probably should be. It's worth considering whether you're just starting out in a marketing role or if you're finding yourselves years in with a lack of direction. Now, traditionally, in my experience, the route to the top, if you like, of a marketing function is the generalist route. You know, you gain a solid understanding of all the disciplines, you rise up through exec, manager, head of, director of, and then finally arrive in the boardroom as a CMO. The specialist role, however, is one that I think a lot of people need to think about. And if we look at how marketing's moved on over the years, there are probably now more disciplines and sub-disciplines in marketing than there ever has been before. And this presents a massive opportunity and equally exciting career paths as well. I've witnessed many people in sort of specialist roles rise through the ranks into really senior positions within large organizations, heads of creative, directors of content, event directors, heads of digital marketing. And as Mark Twain once famously said, find a job you enjoy doing and you never have to work a day in your life. So that really, for me, translates into, you know, finding something that you really enjoy doing. And there's no right or wrong answer here. Just enjoy your work, and I think your career will usually take care of itself. You know, my advice really on that subject is just to do what you love. If you prefer the strategic side of marketing and enjoy managing teams and various stakeholders, then it's probably best you head down that generalist route and work your way up. But if you're passionate about a specific discipline, then focus there. And if salary is important, then work to the top of your specialism within larger organizations. It's a case of doing what you enjoy.
I guess to be able to do that, though, you need to be able to have a very good kind of self-assessment, as it were, of where your strengths and likes and weaknesses and dislikes are. Are there any ways that you could suggest that people go about getting that assessment?
I think it's a case of always getting feedback. You know, I'm working with various different stakeholders across the business. And working out where you're adding the most value to the company that you're working for. You know, in terms of acquiring those sorts of skills, you know, that my main point has always been around attitude. And if I look back through my career, I've probably hired 100 or so people during the 20 or so years in marketing. And whilst there's no winning formula to recruitment, I've always tried to hire 70% on attitude and 30% on aptitude. It's always been my opinion that you can teach someone how to do a job, but you can't put that fire in their belly. You know, and you can't get them to get out of bed in the morning and have that passion and desire. So having a thirst for knowledge and learning, a desire to always improve and enhance what you do, a positive attitude at work, which, by the way, becomes infectious across, you know, the team that you work in. And that sort of relentless pursuit to always do better and the best you possibly can is probably what separates the good from the great within marketing teams I've worked in. I've been really lucky to work with some amazing marketers in my career. In fact, amazing people across probably all job functions. And passion and attitude are always present in the top performers. So love what you do. And if you don't, then go and find it.
Gav Case, Chief Marketing Officer of Red Store. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Dave.
There's some great B2B marketing out there, and I'm joined now by marketing and communications specialist at Hitachi, Sara Fernandez, to look at some of it. Sara, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
So, great B2B marketing out there. What's caught your eye?
There is something that I really admire, which is like having a bold approach to B2B marketing. And I think in that sense, if you want me to talk about something specifically, I think HSBC is a brand that have improved a lot and has really impressed me in the past, I would say a couple of years, with the campaign that they are holding about we're not an island, we're home to so much more. Because I feel like, before all this coronavirus happened, the environment here in Britain, it was all about Brexit and what was going to happen after Brexit. And, you know, as an immigrant myself, I felt a little bit like, well, what's going to happen with my situation? But coming from a well-established company such as HSBC, big bank, which is supposed to talk, you know, more like serious in brackets topics. And we associate the way that banks communicate in a very boring and old dinosaur way. I think their approach to just communicating a very inclusive environment for Great Britain and basically saying to all their customers, both, you know, all the businesses and both their customers, like on a B2C way, that they're welcome anyways, that we're part of something, that they want to continue being part of a bigger community. It's something that I really admire. And I truly believe that companies should take that approach, be bold and think outside of the box. And it's not about content anymore. I think it's about context.
And is it only the messaging that kind of really appeals to you about the HSBC approach? Is there also a design or creative element to what they've done that inspires you?
I think the creativity is very appealing to me because they use their own brand and their logo as the first, you know, visual element. So anything they say on the messaging, you will associate immediately with the HSBC logo. Mm. So that's something that it's very interesting and very like, they did it really well. And I think like a lot of companies should take that approach coming. And this is something that we see every day with B2C companies, such as, for example, Apple. They use their logo on a very meaningful way. And what people associate with that logo is their messaging instantly. A sense of uniqueness, a sense of creativity, and a sense of, oh, this is different. And I am actually buying something or being part of something that is completely different from the rest. And I think by using their logo on their messaging, like we can see that, we used to see that on the tube every day. And now we see that on the bus stops. Whenever I'm walking down and I see a bus stop with some logo on, you know, and I see it like from a very afar, And I see the logo HSBC, and then I see like these black letters. I know that something cool is gonna come up, like a cool message, like where are you from? Is it where you're born, or is it about where your parents from? Or you know, that's a meaningful message that they're gonna tell me.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because they as you say, their messaging is actually from one, I mean, it's very bold, but it by being bold, it's actually quite risky to be able to take a stance, particularly for an institution like a bank, and then to go one further and actually be even bolder by associating your brand so strongly with it. Mm-hmm. There's a real boldness here that impresses.
Exactly, but that's what I think their success is, because I remember reading an article and it was something like 30% more of interactions they had after launching this campaign in particular. So that means that, and especially nowadays in B2B, people don't buy anymore as they used to do back in the 80s or the 90s. People are fed up of corporate messaging, something boring that can apply to any customer. They need to identify with the brand, first of all, and they need to feel that there are humans behind the brand. So I think this particular approach has benefited the brand. And as I said before, I think it was like HSBC, so its number of trades go up about 30%. Yeah. So good job. I really admire whoever created this campaign and obviously everyone like supporting it.
And what have you learned from this that you will be applying to future work, I guess, at Hitachi?
Yes, I think it's, and we are applying it at Hitachi at the moment. So changing a little bit the way we communicate through social media in particular. So having more boldness in our messaging, connecting better with your, with our audiences in changing the tone of the voice, being more meaningful for them, understanding the context that we are, we are suffering at the moment, responding as well. It's it's something that uncommonly, it's especially in B2B, I don't see brands responding to any comment or, query that you might do on social media to them. That's more on the B2C. But actually, as I said before, businesses want to hear and want to engage in conversations online. So that boldness and that, that kind of, I really want to engage with my customers and with my prospects and with my audiences and talk about, topics that a technology company or maybe a bank or, these big enterprises didn't used to talk about. I think it's a good exercise and it's going to bring us closer to our customers.
So be bold. Sara Fernandez, Marketing and Communications Specialist at Hitachi. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's it. That's all for this episode of the Business Marketing Club podcast. Thanks to my guests, Gail Cogswell, Michael Williamson, Lucy Stewart, Gareth Case, and Sara Fernandez. And thanks to you for listening. Please do let us know what you thought of today's podcast. Give us a rating or a review, or drop us a line at businessmarketingclub.org.uk. If you've got something interesting, practical, and visionary to share with our listeners, why not volunteer to be a guest on a future podcast? But no pitches, presentations, or promos, please. We're interested in your thinking and your practical examples. If you have enjoyed the podcast, why not look out in your area for Business Marketing Club mentoring, thought leadership, and events for the business marketing community? In fact, what's stopping you from doing that right now? I hope to see you again. I'm Dave Stevens. Thanks for listening.